you be seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 051076, Exxon Corporation and Exxon Texas versus Emerald Oil and Gas and Lori T. Meisch and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Ravitz, is an argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This is the second installment arising out of the same series of claims brought.
Can we talk about the statute of limitation issue? I think you addressed that very briefly in the last argument.
Yes, sir. Statute of limitations can, in my judgment, absolutely dispose of this entire case except the fraud claim brought on behalf of Emerald. What happened, and Your Honor, we've got a pull out in your behind the timeline, and I apologize that it's long, but that's just the way it is. What happens is that there is evidence that as early as 1990, the royalty owners were being informed by their own experts and their own lawyers that if Exxon carried out its announced intention to plug and abandon the wells and terminate, that there would be waste, that there would be a loss of royalty to these royalty owners, and that information was conveyed to them in 1990, August. If you look, these same royalty owners do not. And there are actually three different sets of royalty owners that sued at different times, but the earliest claim by any royalty owner was in August 29th of 96, in which that pleading kind of mimicked the pleading that Emerald had filed earlier on July 15, 96.
When did Exxon plug the first well?
That's interesting, a good question, because two of the wells included in their damage calculations in this case were plugged in 1972. So Exxon had been plugging wells on this property over a period of time. When they came to the point that from Exxon's point of view, the lease had been economically depleted. It can no longer profitably operate these wells.
Were there wells plugged prior to August of 1990 that are within a year or two of that date?
I would have to look. There is.
Would that be in the record?
There is an exhibit that's in the record that I think shows those plugging dates, but I apologize that I can't give you the reference, Justice Wainwright. But the fact of the matter is, plugging and abandoning these wells had been going on this entire lease that Exxon operated for years. And they were finally down to the last few wells. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that these royalty owners did was they asked, and this is Defendant's Exhibit 82 in the booklet, they asked some people named Walker and McBroom to go in and analyze these and see if there was any continued economic potential. And Walter and McBroom did so. In September 4th of 1990, wrote Mr. O'Connor and said, prematurely plugging these wells would cause unnecessary loss of these reserves to the mineral interest owners. 6 years after that, they brought suit. He also, one of the other claims they say is, well, but you hid from us the potential, and you hid from us information that we only got in discovery. Even though I think, as a matter of fact, the royalty owners didn't have a fraudulent concealment claim, but it doesn't matter because in this very same letter, those experts say, I suggest you pursue access to and copies of Exxon-interpreted geologic information such as structure maps, isopach maps, and sand maps on each reservoir in the field. And they go on to say this data could be invaluable to future development in the area.
If there is a cause of action for improperly stuffing stuff down the hole when you abandon it,
right, sir,
that would be objectively verifiable and inherently undiscoverable, wouldn't it?
No, sir, I don't believe so. I don't believe so at all. It would be objectively verifiable that something was in the hole.
Right.
But in terms of its inherent its discoverability, I think it is discoverable from all of the sources that have been pointed to in this court's jurisprudence, and as a matter of fact, in more than ways. First of all, as was pointed out in HECI versus Neal and Wagner and Brown, they could make inquiry of the lessee. If that didn't work, they could...
Those are production records. I didn't see, is there a place on the... is it the D5 where you put, you know, paper cups and other stuff you throw down the hole?
Is there a place on the D5?
Right. You're basically saying there's regular commission records that would disclose all this. Where on the form do they ask you what kind of detritus did you put in the hole?
There's nothing on the form that would show that, and what the form we submit says...
Well, I'm just wondering. I mean, you know, a doctor could write on the operative report, I left a scalpel and a sponge inside.
Correct.
They usually don't. When they don't, it's considered inherently undiscoverable. You could certainly have discovered by cutting them open again. But I'm just wondering that, you know, that one's been around for 40 years. That's inherent. Sponge left in the abdomen, that's inherently undiscoverable,
that's correct.
Period.
But,
and I don't see how this is any different from that.
Because... the cement company that does the plugging is an independent company. It has to file an independent report. The Railroad Commission employees who are there at the time of the plugging also file reports, and that's what the D8 of the D5 was that I showed you. Third, under Railroad Commission rules, when I'm going to plug a well, I must notify the royalty owners, and they are allowed to come and observe. At that time, they would also be free to question contractors who were involved in the operation. The fact of the matter is, though, Justice Brister, nobody says that it was paper cups or detritus in the hole that caused the problem here. Because remember, one thing they did not bring here was a claim for damage to the real estate. Nor did they offer any evidence that the before and after was different. What they claimed is this was a temporary injury, or at least that was their argument. They now say that there was damage to the real estate. Well, if there was, they failed to present that claim.
If there weren't paper cups in the hole, what was in the hole? What is junk in the hole? I know it's in the Railroad Commission regs, and both parties use it in the briefs. What is junk?
Well, actually, I don't know that they. I think the commission refers to it as non-drillable material is one form. For example. While you're engaged in a drilling operation, you may lose a tool in the hole.
Like a loaded perforating gun?
You could lose that, or you could lose, at times, you may set a packer in the hole, and for whatever reason, somebody forgets to retrieve it.
When I think of junk, I think of stuff in my attic I need to get rid of.
Well,
did somebody back up a truck and... Dump my attic trash in there?
I've got to concede to you.
I'm just trying to get a visual of what the junk is.
And I've got to concede to you, there is testimony from a couple of witnesses, and I think from Mr. O'Connor himself, that he looked down the hole and he saw a rotary drill looking back up at him, that there were wrenches in the hole. It sounded like they unloaded a hardware store into the hole, if you read the testimony. The fact of the matter is, in this case, Emerald was able to complete many of these wells that they complain about. And a critical factor here is, Emerald's own experience here shows that under the economics that existed at this time, this lease had produced past its useful life. Because if you take all the expenses... extra expenses they say they incurred to try to drill around this material or to get drill through it. You take all those expenses and set them aside, and you take the income that Emerald earned less the reduced royalty that they paid to the O'Connors, which was a 30% as opposed to a 50% under the Exxon lease. Emerald lost money. Emerald proved itself these were uneconomic leases. even with Emerald's reduced overhead.
This, all of this could have been treated in the lease, I suppose.
As a matter of...
Expressly, and was not.
Well, one of the things actually, and one of the things we've got in this deal is an example of one lease. This lease is about as detailed as any lease you'll see, and certainly for a vintage lease of this time. It goes so far as to say, after you've dug pits, how you'll set the topsoil aside and then fill in the pits and make sure you put the topsoil back in place to restore. It has a detailed provision about what Exxon will do when it plugs and abandons a well, and it says that they will take every precaution to ensure that oil and gas does not leak out of the well and that salt water and oil and gas does not penetrate some other freshwater zone. It does have those, and one of our claims as it relates to the royalty owners' claims, the O'Connors and the Mishes, is that everything is covered under this lease, and therefore all of their tort causes of action are gone. Because, and we cite to this court's authority in DeWitt County and others, saying that where the lease has dealt with it, you are now dealing with a contractual obligation.
And just so I'll be clear on this, while the lease is in effect,
right, sir.
The lessee owns the well.
Lessee owns the well bore, yes, sir.
And then when the lease terminates, there's a reverter that goes back to the lessor, and then he owns the well. So these provisions in the lease would be to protect that reverter that might be damaged some other way.
That's correct. Protect that right of reverter, and also the lease speaks to one of their big complaints, other than, as Justice Wainwright pointed out, junk in the hole. One of the things they call junk in the hole was tubing that was cut, because the Exxon witness testified they believed they could get a better cement job to seal off freshwater sands, that the tubing was cut and left in the hole. One of the things the lease specifically provides is at the lessee's option, on termination, they may cut the casing and withdraw that casing if they choose to do so. If they don't do it, it becomes the property of the landowner, because it goes back to them under the right of reverter.
Just so I'm clear on this, and to take the worst case scenario, that Exxon deliberately sabotaged these holes to make re-entry harder for any subsequent operator.
Right.
Are you saying that even under those and misrepresented on the forms what they had done to the Railroad Commission, are you saying that even under those circumstances there is no cause of action for either the royalty owners or for Emerald?
I am saying that, Your Honor, because I'm saying it because, first of all, any claims that the royalty owners have were long since dead because of statute of limitations. Secondly, there has been no waste. The oil and gas is there. If it's economic to recover it, it can still be recovered. On the fraud claim, we're saying that if it is not enough under the Ernst & Young analysis, if it is not enough that when an accountant gives a certification in connection with a merger transaction and consents to its inclusion, that there is no evidence of intent on the part of Exxon to defraud anybody with a W-3 that, take the worst case, intentionally didn't contain the information. A W-3, first of all, there's no indication that subsequent lessees like Emerald, who were not even in existence, or somebody that Exxon would understand there was an especial likelihood would resort to these records. The evidence here is even skimpier than the affidavits that were submitted in Ernst & Young. You had an Exxon employee saying, yeah, he knew people might look at those records. You have Mr. John Hayes, an expert for the plaintiffs, who says, well, I advise my clients to look at those records. That is not the sort of evidence that I think this court has held is sufficient to establish. And it does create an unlimited class of plaintiffs, not just people who are stockholders or bondholders. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. Ms. O'Neill and Ms. Hankinson will present argument for the respondent. Ms. O'Neill will open with the first 15 minutes.
Mr. Neal, what interest would Exxon or any other party have to deliberately sabotage a well hole?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
What interest would Exxon or any other party such as Exxon have in deliberately sabotaging a well hole?
You mean why would Exxon do what it did in this case?
May I repeat the question?
Okay.
I don't want to. See if you can answer whatever you think.
I'm trying to understand Your Honor's question, and I'm interpreting.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about them deliberately doing this, that, and the other,
right,
and lying to the commission. Why would it be in their interest to do that?
Why would it be in their interest to do that? Because they have a 50% interest in an adjacent lease producing over a common reservoir. The testimony at the trial, Your Honor, was from their supervisors on site at the time plugging operations were being done that these wells were being plugged in the manner in which they were being plugged.
But as Justice Heck said, in the last argument, just can slide over and continue to work and still hit the well.
Actually, Your Honor, there's lots of reasons why you can't slide over and just continue to work. And an important consideration with respect to Justice Hecht's question is, well, does that mean you're recovering the amount of damages for reserves that you could just slide over and produce? And the answer to that is no. The damage evidence at trial was specifically limited to where recoverable reserves were there that could be produced by drilling a new well. The damages were capped at the amount of the cost to drill a new well. That's the damage evidence in this case. And can you simply slide over? There are lots of considerations at play in this. This is a mature field, like most Texas fields. This is not a situation where it's economically feasible to go in and produce by drilling a bunch of new wells. That is why the Texas legislature chose to adopt severance tax abatements to encourage operators to go back into existing wells to produce remaining reserves out of mature fields and get the severance tax and benefits of those reserves. That's why.
Why aren't you barred by the statute of limitations here?
We were not barred by the statute of limitations. As Justice Brister, I think, has quite succinctly pointed out, this is unquestionably an inherently undiscoverable injury. We have an injury that is essentially entombed in the soil of the earth below many feet of soil, and we have circumstances which Justice Hecht, in his opinion in SB versus RV, indicated we have to look at. We have an intentionally concealed injury. We proved over and over and over again, submitting evidence of the well records that were on file with the state, that Exxon filed a W-3A saying it would do one thing. It actually did something else that was not revealed in any public record and not obtained until 1995, when finally Quintana gave up some of those records so it could get a seismic survey on this property. That information was not disclosed in any public record. And frankly, Your Honors, it is audacious for Exxon to come in on this record and say, well, all these lessors had to do was ask some Railroad Commission employees about what happened out there or go out on the property when it was being plugged, and they would have revealed this damage. That is not the evidence in this lengthy record.
Counsel, do you agree with the Court of Appeals standard in expressing what the rule was on statute of limitations? That is, at one point the Court of Appeals says that the full extent of the damage wasn't known until a certain date, and then expressly says that the statute, the cause didn't begin to accrue until there was enough knowledge of field-wide damage.
Yes, Your Honor. It's taken right out of Justice Brister's PPG opinion. You have to have knowledge of the wrongful injury.
So then if there was damage to 10 wells, let's say there was 121. I know Mr. Ratliff says it's less than that. Seems like it would be. But let's say that there was knowledge in 1990 when the letter was sent saying we're going to sue you, Exxon. There was knowledge that there was a wrongful injury related to 10 wells. Is that enough knowledge of field-wide problems to start the accrual?
Well, two things about
that. How many wells is enough?
Two things about that, Your Honor. The issue we are here on appeal is whether a date different than the dates found by the jury are conclusively established by the evidence. And quite remarkably, There is no question the evidence supports both of those dates, and you ought not, under the review standard, even get to the question of whether there were other dates the jury could have found. But putting the whole review standard aside, on the 1990 evidence that the Exxon wants to rely so heavily on in this case, that entire dispute and all of those documents about which many witnesses testified, in addition to the few documents that you're handed in this exhibit, that entire dispute centered on the last six wells that were producing at the time Exxon was attempting to renegotiate the royalty interest and attempting to close in six producing wells.
Let me come back to the standard again. Whether you are successful or not, I'm putting that to the side. But the standard used by the Court of Appeals is something that got my attention. Mm-hmm. If there was a wrongful injury to one well, and only one, ever, the statute would have begun to accrue in 1990 if the letter said, plugging that well is causing us wrongful injury, you should stop. Right?
No.
If that's what the letter said.
Well, if the letter had said, there's two different things going on here. There's the breach of lease claim and the damage to the wells, which is the waste claim. And I apologize, Your Honor, but you're kind of mixing the evidence on the two. They rely on those 1990 letters on the breach of lease claim, on discovery on the breach of lease claim, which was a fraudulent concealment finding with a discovery date finding. They do not rely on the 1990 letters as evidence to attack the finding on the discovery rule with respect to the waste claim. Now, if there had been a letter in 1990 saying, we've noticed that you're out there throwing junk in the wells, and that's not a proper way to plug these wells under industry standards of the waste statutes, then statute of limitations, yes, would have commenced at least with respect to that well.
So then the Court of Appeals standard distinguishes that situation from a situation where you find the same wrongful injury in 1990 as to one well, but you need to wait until there's multiple findings of injuries to other wells in the field. Does that make sense?
It does make sense because of the consequence that resulted. This is not a situation where these damages would necessarily have been suffered. This injury would necessarily have been suffered because one of your wells was junked up. But when you junk up all of the wells on this lease, when you succeed in your efforts to deter someone from re-entering any of the wells on your lease, now you can't get to your minerals, which is what you're entitled to do. And with respect to that, I'd like to turn back to Justice Heck's comment on the question of, well, doesn't this just make it more expensive to go into the wells, and isn't that really all you recovered for? And the answer to that, Justice Heck, is absolutely not. With respect to the waste claim, first, under the very statute that was violated in this case, it expressly defines waste in part as economic waste. So making it more costly to produce minerals in the state of Texas, our legislature has defined as waste.
Well, but plugging the well makes it more difficult.
Plugging the well makes it more difficult, but there's a difference between plugging a well according to regular industry standards and the costs that are involved in reentering that well.
Let me ask you, just so I'm clear, what I asked the petitioner, which is that when the lease is in effect, the lessee owns the well.
When the lease is in effect, the lessee owns the well, correct.
The lessor has a right of reverter, and if it comes into effect, then the lessor owns the well.
That's correct.
Do you think all of this, these kinds of problems, could be dealt with in the lease by express agreement?
I don't know that all of these problems could be dealt with by the lease in express language.
Looks like you could put in the lease that it'd have to be plugged a certain way. Or I was wondering, could the lessor and lessee agree that the well wouldn't be plugged at all, that would be the lessor's responsibility?
I don't think you could do that, Your Honor, because of the separate statutory obligations to plug wells. I don't think an owner and a lessee can, in fact, I know in prior decisions of this court, you can't vary certain requirements with respect to wells. It's not just your interest. The state has an interest not only in the potential pollution and pollution of water strata and surface rights.
But you could say, it looks to me like, I was just curious whether the lessor could say, well, yes, I know all that needs to be done, and I'll do it if need be, but I want to at least have the right contractually to designate, don't plug these wells because I'm coming in right behind you as soon as you leave and try to operate them myself, and if I can't make it go, then I'll.
Well, in some realm that may be possible, as a matter of practice in the industry, it's not possible. There is no operator who is going to leave a lease with wells, abandon a lease with wells open because of the potential liability that's going to exist for that operator. It's just not going to happen in the industry.
So the right claimed here, basically, when you boil it all down, is a right to have the wells plugged a certain way.
At least according to industry standard and at least according to the rules that govern under the statute. You know, throughout a lease, you know, the operator has the right to operate as a reasonably prudent operator. That's not a difficult standard for someone to have to meet in production or all the other aspects of the lease. And under the statute, we provide them a defense as a reasonably prudent operator.
Are there regulations that govern how a well is plugged?
Oh, there are a plethora of regulations that govern how a well is plugged.
And is there a remedy when wells are not plugged in accordance with regulations?
There is not a remedy for the owner under the statute. The Railroad Commission's ability to grant a remedy is very limited. They can fine somebody for about $10,000, or they can enjoin. Now, the injunction's not going to do you much good where your wells have already been trashed and plugged. And $10,000 is not going to make up for the damage that was done to your ability to recover these minerals. I'd like to speak for a minute more specifically to the rules governing plugging operations. A lot has been said here about the fact that some of these W-3s disclose the fact that that casing had been cut. There was days of evidence at trial concerning the proper method for plugging these wells, and no one stood up and said the way these wells were plugged complies with industry standards. And what happened here was, if you are not going to cut and pull casing, you must perforate it. You shoot it, and you squeeze the cement out through the holes that are perforated into the casing. If you're going to cut casing under the regulations, you have to pull it. Now, it's true that casing gets cut, and it doesn't get pulled, and it remains in the hole. But in the industry, that only happens when an attempt to pull it is made and they can't get it out of the hole. That's important for two reasons. Number one, if you've cut it and you can't get it out, it retains its integrity. It doesn't shift when you attempt to re-enter the hole and you're able to re-enter. Number two, that's not what was done here. There is evidence in this case that Exxon didn't even have the equipment on the lease to attempt to pull the casing. There were the people who were out on the lease doing these operations asked, why aren't we pulling the casing? It would be cheaper to do this. But the cut casing was left in the hole, and even if you go look at that W-3 and it references cut casing, an operator, according to all the evidence, is going to understand that to mean it's stable. Your Honor, I just have a few minutes left, but I would like... Yes.
I'm going to... follow up on the statute of limitations. The letter of August 1990 that you talked about referenced six wells.
Correct.
The last well was plugged about a year later, in 1991, correct?
Correct.
So if the letter was sent claiming improper plugging and waste as to six wells, would there be some, and hard question for your side, notice to at least look into the rest of the plugging that occurred within a year? Because your clients didn't intervene in the case till 1996.
Your Honor, the 1999 letter doesn't speak to plugging. What it's talking about is these are producing wells. We have someone who is interested in coming in and continuing production, taking an assignment of the lease with respect to those six wells. So that person, even though you can't economically produce any longer because you're Exxon and you have high costs and you have a 50% royalty, we have this little operator over here who can come in and economically produce those six wells. And so we would like you to assign the lease to him with respect to the six. So if you plug them in the sense that if you stop production, then that's a waste. because we have another operator who can produce them. That letter is not about improper plugging.
Well, you may be right. The letter I'm looking at is actually dated September 12, 1990, and it says plugging and abandonment of the referenced wells would commit waste and be contrary to public policy and the law. So we move the date back a month. September 1990, at least some of your clients say, if you plug the wells, you're going to commit waste and we're going to sue you. The last of the wells in the whole field is plugged a year later. Mm-hmm. Do you get 5 years to figure out how you're damaged, or just the statute of limitations to figure out it? Another way to put the question is there an obligation that you're on notice to at least look into as of 1991 at the latest, maybe 1990, that there's a problem going on here, the very problem that you identified in your 1991 letter?
That's the problem. It wasn't the very problem. And as Justice Brister pointed out in the Schneider Carriers case, notice of one potential claim is not does not start the statute of limitations running on a completely different claim.
That wasn't my question. My question was notice of problems with six wells, improper plugging and abandonment that would cause waste, the language in your letter, essentially.
Correct.
Doesn't that put you on notice to look into the rest of the field? I didn't say does it start the accrual of the cause of action. That's a different question. Does it put you on notice to look into it? And then the notice time you get is the statute of limitations to look into it.
If there were any facts at the time that gave us any indication that our wells were being plugged improperly, that casing was being cut, and that junk was being thrown in the wells to prevent them from re-entry, that would be one issue.
Why did you write the letter that says plugging will cause waste if you didn't have concerns?
Plugging would cause waste because under the circumstances at the time, there was another operator who could continue to produce the wells profitably. That's the waste that's being discussed in 1990. No one, there is no evidence in this case, none, that any person was aware that Exxon was, meanwhile, out there on the lease, throwing junk down these wells and cutting casing and leaving it. None. There's not a shred of evidence in the record to that. The waste that's being discussed there is closing in, producing wells that an operator could come in and produce. And that's it.
Are you sharing time with Ms. Hankinson?
Yes, I am.
Well, if there are no further questions, we'll hear from Ms. Hankinson.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Exxon takes the position that the Ernst & Young decision forecloses Emerald's fraud claim. It does not. This is the circumstance that the court was talking about in Ernst & Young that gives rise to a fraud claim. On a factual basis, look at the evidence in Ernst & Young. There were Ernst & Young merger-related perspectives that were used to later purchase securities, and it was that factual matter that the court used to determine that there was not an especial likelihood that the defendant would know of that someone was going to rely on the records. This case is not that one. Here's the evidence. Operators routinely and customarily rely on plugging reports in deciding whether to re-enter wells. Exxon admitted it knew subsequent operators would rely on its public reports. Exxon knew at the time it filed the reports that several operators, including a predecessor to Emerald, were interested in redeveloping the tract and attempting to obtain the lease. There is evidence that Exxon sabotaged the wells for the express purpose of preventing their re-entry by just such a subsequent operator. There was evidence that experienced plugging and re-entry professionals said at trial that Exxon's conduct was definitively vindictive and clearly designed to damage the wells in the reservoir.
What is it of importance that there's no claim of drainage in the case?
No, there's not.
Doesn't that indicate that if it had that motive, it's not capitalizing on it? Exxon was trying to draw more minerals out of the reservoir, it's not getting to do that, or you'd sue for it. You'd sue for drainage.
No, Your Honor, the fraud claim, the only thing that is in the directed verdict motion that Exxon talked about was the fact that they said there was no evidence of intent to induce. At the directed verdict hearing, for example, at 11 of the reporter's record at page 120, Exxon said there has been evidence, some evidence at any rate, that there were misrepresentations on the forms W-3 file. Okay? So we've got all the other elements. The only thing we're here on is the question of intent to induce at the time they file the reports. And under the Ernst & Young standard, that evidence that I just recited to you gives that to you. That's all we're here on. I mean, the truth is that Emerald was out on directed verdict on this claim and never went further on it. We never got to the point of putting a damage case on behalf of Emerald or to talk about what that was. The point is that this is a fraud case under Ernst & Young without any question. The drainage claim is not essential. The damages were never, as Ms. O'Neill said, the damage claims by the royalty owners were never in that way. We're talking about whether it's economical to produce these wells and the impact that this fraud, that this tortious conduct caused on the ability to do that. And that's a legitimate claim under Texas law that is separate from a drainage claim. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mr. Rutliff, I think I finally got an answer to the question on why Exxon would have an interest in trashing and thugging the wells. And I think the answer was because a smaller operator can produce this oil cheaper and more profitable than Exxon could. That aside, I mean, what interest would any company have in doing this? And I'm naive to this type of operation out in the field.
I know of no interest. And, of course, you know Exxon doesn't agree that that's what happened, but I have to concede. We had a couple of witnesses that said that. But there is no interest. As a matter of fact, Exxon's economic interest, if it could have gotten all these people so anxious to have this lease, they could have saved themselves all the costs of plugging these wells, which are not insubstantial. What we've got here is what we hear every time they speak is, Junk the hole. Did they sue us for that? No. They did not sue us for junk in the hole. They sued us for waste, the very thing that Justice Wainwright pointed out. They had been told in 1990 that if you do this as to these six wells, you're going to deprive us of, one place in the lyrics says $15 million in royalty income, another place it says $1.5 million. Take the lower number. That normally would get most people's attention. They were told that. They were told that by their own hired experts who had access to the data. But I'd like to go back to something because Justice Brister asked me, well, how would anybody know? Let's take the HECI versus Neal. The injury in that case was damage to an underground reservoir approximately 10,000 feet below the ground. It was not even on the lease. It was on an adjoining tract of land. In those circumstances, this court held that is not an inherently undiscoverable injury, and therefore the discovery rule doesn't come into play. But the honest truth is, on the basis of the facts in this record, it doesn't matter whether it's discovery rule, whether it's fraudulent concealment, or whether it runs from the date that Exxon abandoned the wells. On every claim but the fraud claim, they're barred, because they simply waited too long to proceed. Now, the question was asked, a statement was made that nobody testified that what Exxon did in terms of cutting the casing and leaving it in the hole was a proper way. As a matter of fact, a former Railroad Commission employee testified that's exactly the way the Railroad Commission of Texas plugs and abandons a well. Was exactly the way Exxon. There was evidence to the contrary from other witnesses who said, I've never seen it done that way. But it's not true that nobody had ever done that. When they say there's otherwise no remedy, the fact of the matter is, I think counsel mentioned there was a fine of $10,000. There's a fine of $10,000 a day for improper plugging. The commission can come in and plug it at your expense. and charge you the plugging costs. They can impose other penalties and fines. The Attorney General can come after you, and they can appoint a receiver to operate your other properties.
Penalties and fines for this sort of conduct, if true, of junking the hole.
That's correct. If they find that we did not follow the regulations. So there are other remedies, and this is not a situation in which there needs to be this civil claim. But I want to mention one other thing that just seems to me is totally beside the point here, or is being missed. If they leased to a subsequent lessee, and the question was, did that lessee have to drill a well? They would not judge it on the basis of, could they re-enter the hole and drill it on a cheaper basis? They would judge it on the basis of, can they drill a well from the ground down, recover sufficient hydrocarbons to where they have a probable right to make a profit, a probable profit, after taking into account royalty costs and drilling costs. Their own witness, George Height, said, well, the reason these reserves down here are lost is because you can't afford to drill them. You can't afford to get down there to them. But that does not mean that that means at that time this was an uneconomic property. It may be completely economic today, and if so, they'll be recovered. Another fact that I have not mentioned is in the zones that they identified as having not been properly developed by Exxon, Emerald entered those zones, produced the oil and gas, and paid royalty to these royalty owners that are still suing. On the fraud claim, the only thing I could do there is invite the court to compare the testimony of the Exxon employee and the testimony of Mr. John Hayes about whether there was some expectation, special expectation, that a certain class of people would look at this, and compare that to the affidavits in the Ernst & Young case. I will submit to you that if the Ernst & Young affidavits were insufficient to establish an intent to defraud, the evidence in this record is even more remote from that point. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The clause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the